Good afternoon, Mr. Chief Justice, Justices of the Honorable Court. It's my pleasure to rise today to introduce my colleague Steve Seeger, who has been admitted pro hoc representing Appalese today. With the court's permission, Mr. Seeger will make the argument.
Welcome.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Michael Maimon of Greenbrook Trowick representing appellant Andrew Siegel. May it please the court. The facts underlying this action are all too common. An individual, Dr. Siegel in this case, has valuable technology and requires funds for the development of that technology. Another individual, H. Fisk Johnson in this case, agrees to fund the development of the technology. The individuals form Genetrix, a Delaware LLC, and was formed at the insistence of Dr. Johnson in this case, and entered into an agreement setting forth the individual's rights and obligations. A dispute develops between the individuals. The crux of the dispute in this case is that Dr. Johnson, with the assistance of the other appellees, did not permit Genetrix to obtain financing from third parties, attempted to cram down secured debt financing by Fisk Ventures, the majority equity holder of Genetrix, and an entity controlled by Dr. Johnson. This financing would have given Fisk Ventures additional managerial rights that did not exist under the operative LLC agreement. And finally, Dr. Johnson and the appellees forced Genetrix into insolvency and dissolution with the intent of purchasing the assets of Genetrix during the dissolution process on the cheap. Dr. Siegel filed counterclaims seeking injunctive relief and damages based upon appellee's wrongful conduct. The court below dismissed the counterclaims and ultimately ordered the dissolution of Genetrix. In dismissing the counterclaims, the court below held that appellees did not breach any duties to Dr. Siegel or to Genetrix because no duties were created, and I quote, in the LLC agreement, and thus there were no duties to breach. In so holding, the court below, one, misapplied the law, two, misread the LLC agreement, and three, misread the counterclaims. The court below misapplied the law because duties need not be created in an LLC agreement. Rather, duties are created under common law and such duties exist unless eliminated by the LLC agreement. The court below simply got it backwards, I'm afraid. The court below misread the LLC agreement in this case because the LLC agreement did not eliminate all duties that were created under the common law. Indeed, duties remained that were owed by the managers and the controlling member to Genetrix and to its members. The court below misread the counterclaims because Dr. Siegel alleged that the duties that were not eliminated by the LLC agreement were breached by appellees in their campaign to force Genetrix into insolvency, to cause Genetrix's dissolution, and to purchase Genetrix's assets on the cheap. In this action, I was not involved in the drafting of the LLC agreement, and I was not involved in the litigation below. And the LLC agreement did cause for some very close reading. Of course, it is an interesting and complex agreement to read, but for purposes of this appeal, I did review the agreement to determine the rights and obligations of the parties. After such review, I was amazed because appellee's arguments simply aren't supported by the terms of the LLC agreement. Although appellees argue that no duties were owed by the managers or by the controlling member to Genetrix or to its members, the language of the LLC agreement simply does not support such argument. In fact, the LLC agreement in this action does not eliminate most of the duties that the managers and the controlling member owed to Genetrix and to its members. The first sentence of section 9.1 of the LLC agreement, for example, provides that no member shall have any duty, and now I quote, to any member of the company, close quote, except as expressly set forth in the LLC agreement or in any other written agreement. This sentence does not eliminate common law duties that were owed by a member to Genetrix itself, and did not eliminate common law duties that were owed by a manager to Genetrix or to its members.
Can you explain to me why in a contractual agreement, given the current status of our statutory framework, why there are common law duties owed at all other than the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing?
Your Honor, based upon the statutory framework and the case law which interprets such statutory duties, common law duties still exist unless expressly eliminated. The statute itself provides that such duties exist unless eliminated or limited or expanded upon by the contract itself. As Your Honor knows, and recently wrote in an article, that the common law duties form as gap fillers, which exist unless expressly eliminated. In this case, especially in Section 9.1, the first sentence, it says that the members do not owe duties to other members. It doesn't mention the members' duties to the entity itself, in this case, Genetrex, and does not mention the manager's duties to Genetrex or to the members. Therefore, the common law still exists. It was easy for the parties in this contract to say the managers do not owe any members to the company and to the members, and it was easy for the parties to say that the members don't owe duties to the company or to the members. They didn't do that. Appellees will argue that essentially they did through this very long provisions in the agreement, but that's not what happened here. That's not what the language says, and if the language in the agreement does not exclude the duties, they are included.
Mr. Maimon, even if you're right, that analysis only gets you part way, because even if the agreement read against the background of the statute results in there being common law duties of some kind, the Chancellor went on and addressed very specifically the question of whether those duties, if any existed, had been breached based on the facts alleged in the complaint. And his conclusion, if I understand it correctly, was that the conduct, which was the subject matter of the complaint, that is, the conduct being complained of, consisted essentially of exercising rights that were specifically allowed under the agreement. And therefore, there could be no breach of duty, if any duty there was.
You're right.
Your briefs don't, at least as I read them, do not address that second part of the analysis. They seem to be preoccupied totally with whether there were duties, but don't really discuss in any detail the application of those duties to the facts alleged in the complaint.
Well, the briefs do address that issue in two ways. The first way the briefs address the issue is when appellant argues that the Chancellor called the duties hypothetical duties. The Chancellor didn't believe there were duties. So based upon these hypothetical duties, not actual duties, which are the duties of loyalty and duties of care, the Chancellor viewed these hypothetical duties as not being breached by the facts alleged in the complaint. I think that the factual analysis by the Chancellor was tainted because the Chancellor didn't embrace the legal concept. You can't apply facts to law if you don't really understand the law, and calling them hypothetical duties demonstrates the Chancellor didn't understand the law. And therefore, I think the Chancellor's conclusion that the facts alleged in the complaint did not reflect a breach of duty is tainted because he didn't understand the law.
I don't know what the word tainted adds to the analysis. The Chancellor made a textured analysis of the conduct that was the subject of the complaint, read it against the agreement, and concluded, as a matter of law, that the conduct which was claimed to constitute a breach of duty was conduct that was permitted under the contract among the parties. Calling his mindset tainted doesn't change that, and my point is, and I'd like you to address it, is that your briefs don't squarely take issue with that latter part of the court's analysis.
Now, I'm sorry, Your Honor, if my briefs do not address that, but the position is that if the Chancellor misread the agreement, which we allege, and the Chancellor misapplied the law, which we assert in this appeal, then any application of the facts alleged in the complaint were misapplied because he misread the contract at issue, and he misapplied the law at issue. So if you're misreading the contract and you're misapplying the law, then the facts which you try to apply to that contract and apply to that law, you're not coming to any rational conclusion because the misapplication of the law and the misreading of the contract,
Well, let me ask you a related question. Part of the disagreement here was financing the future of the company. And Dr. Siegel had a vision on how the company should be financed and move forward. And the other people disagreed, voted no, and wouldn't agree. That seems to be an example of what the chancellor was saying was their right under the contract not to agree with Dr. Siegel's proposed method of financing.
Well, the managers of the LLC had an obligation, because the fiduciary duties were not eliminated, had an obligation to act in the best interest of the company and the members. Whether or not Dr. Johnson appointed that manager is irrelevant. Their duties go to the company and the members, and those duties are spelled out in the agreement or under common law. By saying no to Dr. Siegel and only offering secured debt financing by the controlling member, our position is that the managers breached their duties by not seeking alternative forms of financing with third parties. Dr. Siegel sought individual investors through a PPM. Dr. Siegel sought equity investment through other investors, the Class C members. This was all shot down by the managers appointed by Dr. Johnson. The managers, all the managers, including Dr. Siegel, had an obligation to fund the entity, not an obligation to try to shift the assets from the entity to Dr. Johnson. It was secured debt financing, which Dr. Siegel didn't agree to. Then it became this dissolution. And now through the dissolution process, it's probably cheaper for Dr. Johnson to get the assets this way. Through the dissolution process, he's ultimately going to end up with the assets. So the managers of the LLC, whether or not they were appointed by Dr. Johnson or not, had an obligation to protect those assets for the company and all its members, not just the Class B members. And to go back to Justice Jacobs' question, if you read the counterclaims, and I cite them in the brief, but they're on pages A229 through A238, this is a notice pleading standard. I don't understand how the chancellor could have determined that the facts alleged in the complaint on a Rule 8 standard for the individual claims, and even if 23.1 does apply to the derivative claims, which arguably it may not, but under any pleading standard, I don't see how the chancellor could have held that the specific allegations pled in many, many paragraphs over many, many pages didn't satisfy a Rule 8 standard. So it all relates back to the chancellor misinterpreting the law, misapplying the law, and misreading the contract. That created this issue, which in turn impacted the way the chancellor applied the facts.
Well, that sounds like it's a very abstract argument. I mean, the chancellor didn't deal with this in the abstract. He dealt with it concretely and found, based on his reading of the complaint and based on his reading of the party's agreement, that the conduct that is charged, you know, with which the defendants were charged, or I should say the counterclaim defendants were charged with breaching duty, was conduct that was specifically allowed by the agreement. You haven't addressed that in any, at the factual level. That is, you haven't shown how that analysis is wrong. What you've done is just say, well, the court misread the contract, misread the complaint or the counterclaims, and therefore his analysis was tainted.
Well,
Your Honor, the question is how and why.
Hey, how his analysis is tainted is that if you do not understand the law and you misread the contract, you look at the facts pled in a complaint, and may highlight again, it's a Rule 8 standard, and look at those facts and say, well, these facts which are pled in the complaint, if I apply them to the law which I'm misapplying, don't show a breach. And if I apply these facts, there's the Tilton term sheet, which is alleged in the complaint, which Dr. Siegel tried to get financing, equity financing, equal to the $500,000 that Fisk Ventures was trying to cram down on the company. But it was equity financing rather than secured debt. There was no chance of Mr. Tilton taking the assets of the company. He would just be an equity holder like any other equity holder. There was the PPM, which wasn't permitted to be circulated for third-party investment. That wasn't promoted. At the same time, Fisk Ventures was trying to cram down $500,000 in secured debt. So if you believe that there are no duties, and that's what the chancellor held, there are no duties created by the contract, then it doesn't matter what Dr. Siegel alleged in the complaint. But if you do look at what Dr. Siegel alleged in the complaint, and you do apply the common law as should have been applied, and you do read the contract as should have been read, then you look at what Dr. Siegel pled in the complaint, and you say to yourself, these are facts that at least entitle Dr. Siegel to discovery. There was no discovery in this action. The chancellor didn't even permit Dr. Siegel to replead. He dismissed the complaint.
Well, counsel, is it possible to characterize it in the following way? When the chancellor refers to hypothetical duties, let's assume by that he means the common law duties of loyalty and care, and you accept the fact that in the abstract or the default position would be in the absence of specifically eliminating those duties, that the governing committee or the board, however you want to characterize them, owe duties to the entity and to the investors that are consistent with loyalty and care. But here, the actions they took that are alleged to have constituted a breach of those common law duties were in fact actions authorized under the agreement without the rubric of duty of loyalty or duty of care. So can it be that what he was concluding is, well, in the abstract, these might be violations of the common law duties, but here, the LLC agreement allows these specific actions, therefore, they're not duties owed and they can't be breached. Is that a way of construing his
I don't believe so, because what Your Honor says, these are not duties owed and they can't be breached, you're putting the rabbit in the hat at that point. I think you need to read the agreement with a fresh set of eyes.
Well, let me recharacterize it. Let's say there's no reference to the common law duties of loyalty and care in the context that you described. However, there are specific provisions of the LLC agreement that authorize conduct that, absent that authorization in the agreement itself, would or could constitute a breach of common law duties. That is a way of eliminating common law duties consistent with the statute by authorizing a certain set of acts. The typically easy situation is authorize the managers to invest in a way that's inconsistent with the best interest of in their own right, that's inconsistent with the best interest of the entity. Is that what he was talking about here?
Well, I believe that is what he was talking about here, except once again you have to go to the terms of the contract and see what was eliminated and what still existed under common law, and frankly, what was created under contract.
Well, I think that's where Justice Jacobs, and I don't presume to speak for Justice Jacobs, but I think that's where he was going with his questions. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us where the chancellor got it wrong when he said there were no rights of the managers to act in the way in which they did that could arguably constitute an elimination of their fiduciary duty of loyalty and care?
Okay, if you read the agreement, Your Honor, and you look at the common law, Dr. Siegel had the ability to raise many claims under the contract and under common law. Dr. Siegel could assert direct claims against the managers for injunctive relief. Injunctive relief was not impacted at all by the LLC agreement, at all. In fact, Dr. Siegel attempted to limit the ability of Fisk Ventures and the affiliates of Fisk Ventures to bid on the assets of Genentech Trex if it actually was put into dissolution. Dr. Siegel was seeking injunctive relief directly. That wasn't impacted by any provision of the agreement. The agreement's silent as to that. Dr. Siegel could assert derivative claims against the managers and the members for injunctive relief based upon bad faith conduct. Dr. Siegel alleges that the conduct alleged in the complaint alleges bad faith, turning down third-party financing and trying to cram less favorable financing down on the company at the same time. At a minimum, he's entitled to discovery for that. Dr. Siegel could assert direct claims against the managers and the members for damages based upon intentional misconduct and gross negligence. This was not affected by the agreement. Dr. Siegel could allege derivative claims against the managers and the members for damages based upon the bad faith conduct. This was not affected by the agreement. There were specific areas that Dr. Siegel could allege claims against the appellees, he did allege those claims, but because of the misreading of the agreement and the misapplication of law, the court dismissed those claims without discovery, without an opportunity to replead, without anything. And I'm saying that the common law and the agreement, read fairly, permits Dr. Siegel to enforce certain rights. And the courts below said that Dr. Siegel did not have the ability to enforce any rights. And my time is up, Your Honor.
If there, you want to save your, the balance of your time?
5 minutes, Your Honor?
Yes.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I'm Steve Seeger, and along with John Abramczyk, I'm counsel for the appellees. This case is about a deadlocked, limited liability company that needed to dissolve, but at a more basic level, this case is about the freedom of contract. One of the hallmarks of Delaware law is the freedom of contract, and the great deal of certainty that agreements will be enforced as written. That long-standing tradition is especially strong in the context of limited liability companies. The legislature specifically provided that the animating purpose of the act was, quote, to give maximum effect to the principle of freedom of contract and to the enforceability of limited liability company agreements, unquote. The position taken by Dr. Siegel in this case is the polar opposite of the freedom of contract approach. Instead of enforcing the LLC agreement, Dr. Siegel seeks to rewrite the contract and eviscerate the express contractual rights of the Class B members. Dr. Siegel agreed in the contract that he did not have the power to control the company, and he agreed that the Class B members did have veto power over his proposals. Yet Dr. Siegel now attempts to change the terms of the deal. Dr. Siegel freely and voluntarily entered into an agreement with a very specific corporate governance structure. The parties specifically agreed on a supermajority voting requirement. You can find this in the appendix at page 274. It's section 7.2 of the agreement. The parties agreed that the board couldn't take any action unless 75% of the representatives agreed. By definition, that structure gave veto power to each side. Neither side had a right to get its way, and neither side had a duty to capitulate to the other. Now, that structure was no accident. As Dr. Siegel concedes on page 7 of his brief, and it's in paragraph 101 of the amended complaint, the parties negotiated this agreement for over a year. And Dr. Siegel's sophisticated. He's a physician. He studied and worked at Harvard and MIT. He knew exactly what he was doing. He knew exactly what he was getting. And he knew he did not have the power to control the company. Yet Dr. Siegel attempts to change all that in this lawsuit. Dr. Siegel complains in his complaint about the long history of failed negotiations. He complains that the parties didn't see eye to eye on the Tilson term sheet, the Fisk-Ventures term sheet, the PPM, the 2006 and 2007 buy-down proposals. He complains about the fact that he didn't get his way, and he complains about deadlock and disagreement. Yet the existence of deadlock and disagreement isn't a breach of anything. Instead, it's an express contractual right. The Class B members bargained for and achieved a contractual right to disagree with Dr. Siegel, and Dr. Siegel is now attempting to enforce the agreement that he wished he had rather than the contract that he actually had.
Well, can they disagree for any reason or in bad faith?
The contract gives them a plenary right, Your Honor, to vote as they please. So it's up to the Class B members and Dr. Siegel, I might add, to vote their interests as they please. Dr. Siegel rejected proposals that the Class B members made. My clients made proposals about a buy-down proposal in 2007 and about a Fisk Ventures term sheet.
Well, can they disagree in bad faith?
The agreement does not put any constraints on the ability to vote as you please. So I think it's a plenary right that can be exercised in an unfettered way. And I think in this particular case, Your Honor, I think the facts reveal that the reason that they voted is they didn't want to give up their express contractual rights. And that's something they simply didn't have any obligation to do.
So is the answer to my question yes?
The answer is yes, that they have an unfettered contractual right to vote as they please.
Do you think that the complaint pled facts that would be consistent with sufficient specificity of bad faith?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. The chancellor ruled that Dr. Siegel didn't allege bad faith. In an ordinary case, you would expect the appellant's brief to come forward and say, here are the facts that show there was bad faith. This is why it's not conclusory. Here are the facts I have. That didn't happen in this case. Instead, Dr. Siegel's brief says that the chancellor was conclusory when the chancellor said that Dr. Siegel was conclusory. That's on page 26. He says that he wants discovery to determine if, and that's a quote from page 5 and 26 of his brief, to determine if there was wrongdoing. He alleges the mere, quote, possibility of wrongdoing. That's, again, from page 26 of his brief. You know, the appellant's counsel cited Rule 8. Rule 8 does not allow you to plead mere allegations in a conclusory fashion, just the elements of the cause of action, and just parrot the elements in a conclusory way. You need concrete facts, not assertions in a conclusory fashion. You know, the U.S. Supreme Court has been discussing this. They just decided Ashcroft versus Akbal, which is 129 Supreme Court, 1937. And they talked about the fact that in the context of Rule 8, which is the identical language, you can't just allege the possibility of wrongdoing. And that's consistent with the longstanding practice here in Delaware. And that's all he did. He tried for the first time to offer facts on page 8 of his reply brief. But even then, the facts that he offers just on that one page, he offers five of them or tries to, they're merely an expression of an express contractual right. He again alleges the parties couldn't agree on the PPM, the various term sheets. But again, Section 7.2 of the agreement is clear. Both parties have a right to vote as they please, and they have an express contractual right to disagree with each other. That's addressing the element of good faith. Putting aside that issue, there's even a more fundamental issue here, that the conduct that he alleges,
well,
just
before we leave good faith, I mean, the real area of dispute here was financing, was it not?
Yes.
And the parties just could not agree on any particular financing proposal, correct?
That's close, Your Honor. There were a number of proposals that they did agree on.
All right.
I can.
But, yeah, I mean, is it not fair to say that what divided the parties here was that the Class B members had a put, and that as a condition of getting financing that would have been acceptable to Dr. Siegel and his allies, that the members that had the put would have had to either waive it altogether, that is their right to seek it, or to postpone it for some indefinite period, and they weren't required to do that.
That's right, Your Honor. There's not a contractual duty to give up a contractual right. There's not a fiduciary duty.
Right. So if the reason that they voted, I mean, you know, the good faith issue really depends on whether we're talking about those members in their capacity as members or as directors, correct? As members, they could vote for whatever reason. But, you know, I guess the implicit argument is that as members of the board, they were constrained by fiduciary duty.
There are elements of both, Your Honor. Sometimes he alleges that we acted in our capacity as members. Sometimes he's discussing that we acted as a representative.
Okay.
In terms of acting as a member, Your Honor, you certainly don't have a contractual duty to give up a contractual right. I think that is equally true with the fiduciary duty. You don't have a fiduciary duty to give up a contractual right.
And my question was, isn't that essentially what the Chancellor found here?
I think that was a strong undercurrent, Your Honor. Dr. Siegel has, I think, 15 or 20 paragraphs in his complaint where he talks about the fact that the Class B members didn't give up their express contractual right, the put right. They didn't have an obligation to do that. There was no contractual or fiduciary obligation to give up a put right. The put right was a part of the deal from the very beginning. My client invested almost $1 million at the inception of the company, and one of the things that he specifically bargained for was a put right. And
so if the unwillingness to give up that put right was the reason for those parties vote in their capacity as directors, then that could not constitute bad faith.
It could not. And there are all sorts of other elements of the history of failed negotiations. And another example is the PPM. Dr. Siegel circulated the PPM in August, and my clients gave him one comment. In December, he wanted approval of the PPM and wanted approval immediately. My clients said that, you know, they have a new representative on the board, they'd like to have a board meeting. And Dr. Siegel said, no, I want it approved, and I want it approved now. My clients didn't breach a fiduciary duty by requesting a board meeting. This is paragraphs 150 and 151 of the allegations. There's no obligation, fiduciary obligation, to approve something right away without a board meeting. There's no duty to proceed without a meeting. And the other allegations about the buy-down proposal, the various buy-down proposals, the Tilson term sheet, they simply discuss a history of failed negotiations. If I could talk about the Fisk Ventures term sheet, Dr. Siegel complains about the fact that my client proposed terms for financing that Dr. Siegel disagreed with. That's fine. The parties couldn't agree. But the Class B members didn't have a fiduciary duty or a contractual duty to make a proposal that Dr. Siegel liked. The parties are certainly amenable to make whatever proposals they want, and if the other side disagrees, well, then the agreement worked. That's how the agreement's supposed to work. The parties didn't agree. If you've got deadlock, that's just a necessary consequence of the...
Well, where do we go with a construction of the situation that, yes, the members that you represent, either in their capacities members or members, voting representatives on the governing body within the corporate governance structure you described, everything they did was consistent with language in the agreement that allowed them to take the action they did. Let's assume that for a moment. But what if the allegation here is, yes, they did exercise rights they had under the contract, but they were unreasonably exercising those rights for a purpose different than a purpose that was in the best interest of the entity as a whole. It was to create an ultimate result that favored one set of members over the other, and that constitutes, if not bad faith in the traditional common law fiduciary duty sense, it's a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing that's inherent in or implicit in every contract. Is that not pled in the complaint?
Let me address the latter first, Your Honor, the implied covenant of good faith. This court said in State Farm versus Dunlop that the implied covenant of good faith is not a means for requiring somebody to act reasonably. This court specifically addressed it in footnote 22, that reasonableness is not the standard. You don't have the standard is not trying to soften express contractual rights. The implied covenant of good faith is not a means of taking away something that somebody's bargained for. And that's a principle that pervades the law. We've quoted a number of cases, a number of jurisdictions that have addressed that. So I don't think reasonableness would be the standard there. And I think, turning to the fiduciary duty claim, there are many cases that talk about implied preemption, where you've got a system of rights and remedies in the agreement, and parties can find that the expression of those rights and duties means that it's inconsistent with the fiduciary duties. We quoted Vice Chancellor Strine in the RSM case in our brief, talking about how you have to read the fiduciary, you have to read the contract in a manner that would give practical and efficient operation to the agreement, and you can't allow the fiduciary duties to intrude upon that.
Let's take reasonable or unreasonable out of the equation, and let's simply say that Class B, or however you want to call the group that you represent, in exercising their contractual rights, it really wasn't for the purpose that those rights were granted in the first instance or bargained for and negotiated for in the first instance. We've reached a factual situation in context where they're taking the actions they're taking in order to skew the table at the end to favor one set of investors over another. And that's not what was intended by the parties when they entered into the original contract. And that's where the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing come in, because in the exercise of a contractual right that you have, can you exercise that right in a way that can be construed to be bad faith? And was that bad faith pleaded in this complaint?
I don't think, let me start with the latter. It wasn't pleaded in this particular complaint. He sprinkles allegations of bad faith and gross negligence without backing it up factually. A number of the allegations are offered, quote, upon information and belief, unquote. Turning to the broader question of how the interplay with the contractual right and the fiduciary duties, I think it gets back to the contract. And if the contract gives one party an express contractual right, then under the case law, that right can't be intruded upon by a fiduciary duty.
I don't want to conflate fiduciary duty and the implied covenant of good faith and fair deal. Let's take fiduciary duty off the table.
Yes.
What in the context of an LLC on these facts must one plead in order to assert that there's been a breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing?
The breach of the covenant of good faith and fair dealing exists when somebody tries to take opportunistic advantage of the other side by exploiting a gap in the contract in a way that parties wouldn't have anticipated when they entered into the contract. So that principle applied here just simply doesn't work, because when you agree on a structure that gives both sides veto power, inherent in that arrangement is the possibility that you won't agree with each other. Veto power is inherent in that.
I think I understand that. That makes perfect sense. But did they plead the next level of conduct, which would be, it isn't exercising our right to vote the way in which we want to vote simply because it's in our best interest at the moment. We've reached a point near dissolution where if we continue to maintain our position in this way, we can skew the final resting place of the value of this entity in the hands of one group as opposed to another. It isn't a genuine disagreement over the funding mechanism that will enhance the long-term value of the entity. It's a short-term gain for our side by taking the position we're taking. And that, if pleaded with sufficient facts to support it, could it constitute an allegation of a breach of the duty from the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing? Because it's saying the contractual right, and instead of using it in a way that's fair and reasonable and understandable, to advancing your own interest because you simply differ with the other side's view of what's in the best interest of the entity, this is skewing it for your side at the end of the day, and the entity itself be damned. Is that pleaded?
I don't think so, Your Honor. There are a few conclusory allegations where he says his theory of the case, where he says, I think that they were trying to take over the company. He doesn't offer facts. He offers a theory.
Well, he argued today that dissolution favored one group because they could pick up the assets far more cheaply after dissolution than they could in a cross-the-table bargaining right now. And that's the real reason. That's the heart of why they exercised their contractual right the way in which they did.
Yeah, I'm glad you raised that. The parties have a dissolution provision in the LLC agreement. My client exercised his contractual right to seek dissolution, and the dissolution has proceeded so far in accordance with the LLC agreement. So the notion that the Class B members were somehow doing something improper by seeking dissolution, that just doesn't square with the agreement at all, because the parties are certainly entitled to seek dissolution, and there's a process in place under the agreement for dissolution. That Dr. Siegel would like you to believe that once dissolution happens, somehow the Class B members are going to get the assets. That's not what the agreement says. The agreement sets out this whole scheme for how the assets should be sold in dissolution. There's an independent court-appointed liquidator. He has to liquidate the assets in accordance with the agreement. And he wants you to believe there's some sort of power grab going on, that if there's dissolution, somehow we're going to get the assets. That's not what the agreement says. That's not what's happened.
Well, let me ask you a question about the record. It appears that most of Dr. Siegel's plans for financing involve the Class B shareholders modifying or giving up their right to a put. Is that correct?
To a large extent, that's right, Your Honor, yes.
So, by analogy, if the Class B shareholders had a superior secured position, it's like saying to them, we'd like you to subordinate your position for the good of the company. And the Class B shareholders simply said, we're not modifying the put, or in other words, we're not giving up what we've contracted for. We want to insist on our contractual rights.
Yes.
So that's your characterization of the overlay of the nature of the disagreement, which is morphed into this discussion of bad faith, covenant of good faith and fair dealing, and fiduciary duties.
There are two components, Your Honor. The put right is certainly part of it. You have a contractual put right. You don't have a duty of any kind to give up that right, so that's certainly true. The other element is, again, to go back to Section 7.2 of the agreement, we had a right to agree or disagree with financing proposals. And fortunately, the parties were able to agree on a lot of proposals. That's why my client invested, you know, four or five or maybe six times, almost $3.5 million into this entity. So a lot of times the parties were able to agree, but sometimes they couldn't. And when they couldn't agree, that's simply, you know, the exercise of an express contractual right.
Any further?
I didn't address dissolution and personal jurisdiction, but unless the court has any additional questions, I think I've...
You've got 4 minutes and 55, 54.
I got the same time here, Your Honor. All right, thank you.
Thank you.
I'd just like to address a few points raised by my friend over at Appellee's table. The put right seems to be a major issue, but let's look at what happened here. The PPM was never circulated, so we'll never know if a third-party investor based upon the PPM would have objected to the put right. We just don't know because Appellee's wouldn't let the PPM be circulated. The Tilton term sheet took into account the put right. Tilton was agreeable to the put right. Tilton asked for to be an observer on the board, and Tilton was willing to put in $500,000 in new investment through equity. That the put right wasn't an issue there. My friends said no Tilton term sheet. But Fisk Ventures will give you $500,000 in secured debt at the same time. So this put right is a red herring. The PPM was never circulated, so we'll never know how investors felt about the put. Tilton agreed to the put, and that's put in the complaint. So this whole concept of a put right really doesn't get you anywhere because we just don't know because of the conduct of Appellee's. Now let's talk about voting as we please. There is nothing in this agreement which permits Fisk Ventures, Rose, Dr. Johnson to vote as they please. My friends over here read out the words bad faith. That's in the agreement. My friends over here read out the words intentional misconduct. That's in the agreement. My friends over here read out the words gross negligence. Gross negligence, which is usually eliminated under 102b7. That's in the agreement. They read that away too. These are standards that are in the agreement, and these are linked to common law principles, which the Chancellor said did not exist because they were not created under the agreement. So this whole concept of vote as one pleases just doesn't hold any water if you read the agreement. Now let's talk about covenant of good faith and fair dealing. If you operate a board not to the benefit of the company and all its members, but to the benefit of the Class B members, and you stonewall finance and you stonewall the PPM, if it was a timing issue and they wanted more time to study it, they could have had another meeting, and they could have circulated the PPM. Why wasn't the PPM circulated? Because the Class B didn't want it circulated. Put right or no, they didn't want it circulated because there may be an investor out there that would accept the put right. So let's not chance that. So Dr. Siegel goes to Mr. Tilton and gets $500 of equity investment. Well, he'll take the put right. Well, don't want that either because that stops us from cramming down this debt, secured debt financing, which we would accept because we get control of the asset.
Can I interrupt for a second?
Yes, Your Honor.
If I understand correctly, either side had the power to block a financing proposal, right? And that was part of the agreement?
No, I don't read the agreement that way, Your Honor.
The fact that it required a 75% approval didn't have a flip side be that either side could block an approval?
We must distinguish who's wearing a hat at this point. The managers could block the approval. You need a 75% vote of the managers, but the managers had to act in good faith. They couldn't act in bad faith.
Okay, well, yeah. All right, fine. So either side could block a financing proposal. If one side decided, you know, this is not working out, we aren't able to run a business here and see things eye to eye, I'm not going to approve anything that the other side proposes, because this is just not a functional organization. Is that a breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing?
If the reason to decide that is to actually get control of the assets in the dissolution process, yes, it is. In this case, Fisk Ventures is the 800-pound gorilla. No one or very few people are going to try to bid against Fisk Ventures to get these assets through the dissolution process. In fact, Dr. Siegel, in his complaint, said, if this goes to dissolution, I ask two things. The first thing is that Fisk Ventures not be the receiver, which Fisk Ventures isn't, but that Fisk Ventures not be permitted to bid on the assets. Because if everyone wants out of the enterprise, everyone should get out of the enterprise, and they should collect what's reasonably available to a third-party offer. And that's the problem we have here. We were not permitted to take discovery, to determine whether it was good faith or bad faith, and to see whether Fisk Ventures should be permitted under the doctrine of unclean hands, whether they forced the dissolution to get control of these assets. And that's what this complaint is all about. If the chancellor said we're dissolving, but Fisk Ventures shouldn't be permitted to bid because of its conduct, we wouldn't be here today. The receiver would do what the receiver does. Get it? Finish my sentence?
No, finish your sentence. Yeah.
Thank you,
and finish your answer to Justice Berger's question.
Thank you, Your Honor. The receiver would deal with third parties, they would sell the assets, and we would use the LLC agreement to determine the distribution of the assets outward. Having Fisk Ventures as part of that process, they put themselves there to get these assets, and that's what this complaint's about.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take the case under advisement to assess.
Please rise.